on the far right here, CEO of 420 Radio, among other things. Normal Zone, Russ Belville. Chair of Washington Normal and the man who taught me that marijuana may be a weed, but it's not effortless to grow, Kevin Oliver. And National Normal's Outreach Director, Kevin Malmalji. So I was hoping you guys would each speak for 5 minutes, and then we'll open up questions between you guys, and then questions from the crowd here. Take it away, Russ.
All right. Dr. Mitch mentioned, my name is Russ Belville. I'm the executive director of the new Portland Normal chapter in Portland, Oregon. Also the head of 420 Radio, which is a 24-hour marijuana legalization talk radio network. You turn it on, someone's talking about weed. And we got shows from green states and from red states, so you get all the perspectives you need to hear. I also, on that network, host a two-hour live daily talk radio program, The Russ Belville Show. First hour is a podcast that you can get on iTunes and all the other podcast aggregators. We also have an app that's available, the 420 Radio app for iPhone or Android. And every Monday, I talk with Dr. Mitch. We discuss cannabis science and latest polls and studies. Every other Thursday, I talk with folks from law enforcement against prohibition. You know, what's the cop's perspective on legalizing drugs? So for the past, 2008, that's 7 years, I've been talking about marijuana every day and reading about it every day. And I feel fortunate to have moved to Oregon in 2005, and this is my 10-year anniversary of doing marijuana law reform. I got involved with Oregon Normal. I met the incomparable Madeline Martinez, who pulled me right into, full speed ahead in marijuana legalization. Yeah. Once you get involved with her, things happen really quick. Worked for National Normal for 4 years, 2008 through 2012, doing Kevin number two's job. We have two Kevins here, so I have to keep track of them. Of course, I'm living in Oregon now, and it's been an interesting journey because when I first started in reform, we had 13 medical marijuana states, and the Gallup polls were 33% in favor of legalization. Since I got involved, we've legalized 4 states, and the polls are over 50% nationwide. So, you're welcome. No, I had very, very little to do with it. It's just a joke. But it's been interesting watching things unfold in Oregon, because Oregon was the first place to decriminalize marijuana back in 1973. And one of the 3 states that were the second round of medical marijuana states back in 1998. So you'd think, pretty progressive audience, pretty tolerant, and pretty weed friendly. And to a large extent, that's true. But it's been interesting trying to negotiate getting Measure 91 passed that legalized in 2014, and comparing that to our 2012 effort that failed the same time when Washington and Colorado were passing their legalization. So it's been an interesting way to learn what doesn't work and what does work. And now, of course, the big fight we're having is integrating the new recreational scheme, and what does that mean for medical marijuana, and how does that affect and change things? And I know Kevin Oliver will be telling you a whole bunch about that too as well, because we're up in the Pacific Northwest where this seems to be the big battle that's going on right now. Most recently, I got involved, formed Portland Normal with Randy Quast back there, who came over from Minnesota, and we decided we would get involved with putting the normal word back out in the Portland area. And I'm just thrilled to be here in Washington, D.C., and being a part of this lobby day. Look forward to answering any questions you might have.
First of all, I'd like to thank Normal for putting this together for all of us, and it's a great opportunity for all of us. I think I've learned a lot just sitting here this afternoon, and I thank Keith and Alan and everybody for showing up. It's just amazing. We got my map up. All right, so my name's Kevin Oliver. I've come from Washington State, the Canada of the United States, and I guess we can get to the map in a minute. I run the state affiliate for Washington Normal. I was elevated to that actually when Russ was the chapter director back in 2004 or 5 or something like that. We have 4 really active chapters in 4 of the most populous counties. And when I say really active, what I've found since post-legalization is the administration of of group meetings and having a large membership is almost a full-time job. And post-legalization, there's an awful lot of other priorities, I would say, that tend to come up in some instances. One way I like to say it is, I've never worked so hard for pot in my life. And you know, going and talking about it, and you'll all have this opportunity once you get past legalization to see what I'm talking about. When you're in the states that aren't legal prior to Washington's legalization, it's really exciting to throw up a normal banner and hand out the literature, and you know, it makes the most sense. It's not full repeal of prohibition, but it's really the most logical and most effective form of legal of policy reform, I think, out there as far as groups that represent policy reform. And having that that booth, whether it's at a family event or a hemp fest, you know, the conglomeration of people that are just so excited to come talk about it. You see the passion. Every one of you has seen the passion. You're here because you're passionate. You know what I'm talking about. Post-legalization, people who you thought were your allies and friends suddenly aren't your allies, and they never were your friends. And it's strange. I think we'll probably all get into that a little bit. Russ is correct. We're wrapping up an extended budgetary session. We have industry groups that have popped up overnight, representing. You'll pay them. They'll tell you what you want them to say, and then they'll make an appointment with a legislator who is, of course, obligated to give them 15 minutes of lip service, and they'll ignore people like the ACLU, whose sphere of influence goes far beyond politicking for pot, when they say we don't want a revenue share with the counties to bribe them to come on board. I'm not going to get into the politics that's going on. It's insane. Moving from pre to post legalization, it was a lot of fun. It's still a lot of fun, but it's an awful lot more work. Plus, I have a tier 3 licensed production and processing facility. I'll be putting 2,000 plants in the ground in a couple of weeks. And so when I say I've never worked so hard for pot in my life, I mean it. It's hard.
Well, thank you guys for sitting through another one of my presentations here, or panel discussions, I should say. I appreciate my panelists here. Russ and Kevin, number one, I guess it is. I think it's interesting to both of their points. There's a lot that happens post-legalization that you don't really expect. Of course, as I referenced earlier, when I was in the trenches for Amendment 64, knocking doors, gathering signatures, making phone calls, you know, there were several other individuals that were right next to me in that fight. Now that legalization has hit, we've now divided. It's a fractured community. We have industry groups, we have consumers, and then we have patients. And then from that, you have, it makes it incredibly difficult for you to have a true, honest discussion about what makes sense from a policy standpoint, right? Because you have patients looking out to make sure that they're not being short-sighted with the new implementation of recreational marijuana. You have industry, again, looking out for access to banking, fair taxation, other issues that don't really pertain to consumers. And so, you know, I'm seeing post-legalization, a lot of people, Alan mentioned this earlier, a lot of people have asked, well, what is Normal going to do now that it's, you know, marijuana is legal in 4 states in the district? Well, in my personal opinion, the work's just started, you know, because we have money from the industry. They're able to effectively penetrate the legislature with their messaging due to the resources that they have. And of course, Patients Alliance, they've been around for a long time in Colorado, and they have deep relationships with lawmakers, and you know, and so the consumers are just kind of, the recreational consumers are just left out there, you know, and that's where I feel Normal is going to make the most impact post-legalization, is making sure that we're showing up to these stakeholder meetings, making sure that you're participating in, you know, committee meetings with the city council, that you're part of the discussions when it comes to taxation. You're part of the discussions when it comes to limitation of plant counts. So that's kind of where I envision Normal moving forward with the post-legalization efforts.
Can I kick in the first question and then we'll...
Yes.
No.
Yes.
What is up with the medical and recreational at the same time? Help me.
Wow.
All right, let me start. So the three states, you know, we're not going to count Alaska this time, but Alaska is a little bit different because it doesn't really have a really entrenched medical program. I mean, they've had medical since 98, but dispensaries, caregivers, it's, there's not a whole lot going on there. Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, I think, are very illustrative in this. And I'd point out that of the three of our states, I think Colorado's had the best time of it, and primarily for two reasons. Number one, their medical system was very, very integrated. I mean, very strict regulations and a government agency, the Marijuana Enforcement Division, which was medical Marijuana Enforcement Division before. But they already had a very strict kind of regulatory structure over their medical. And the legalization they passed wasn't that different than the medical, as far as I think if you guys get 2 ounces if you're medical, one if you're, yeah. So there wasn't a huge disparity on possession limits, plant limits, and all of that. The one thing that does remain, I'd say, in Colorado is that tax difference, the tax differential. Right. It's a lot cheaper to grow, buy it if you're on the medical side. But Washington and Oregon, it's been difficult because we in the Pacific Northwest have had for about the past, well, Oregon changed theirs in 05. I don't remember when Washington did the 60-day agreement of what 60 days was going to be, but around the mid-2000s. Since then, for about a decade, both Oregon and Washington have had the most generous medical marijuana statewide. California has patches here and there, but statewide, we have the most generous medical marijuana. In both states, 24 ounces of possession, pound and a half. It's pretty generous. In Oregon, 6 mature plants, 18 immature. In Washington state, they decided 60-day supply was 15 plants. So a lot of plants as well. So we ended up with a situation where over the past decade or so, a very large contingency of patients and the people who care for them and the people who grow for them got used to very large limits and pretty lax oversight. There's grower cards and there's divisions, and but not intense oversight. So as we passed recreational legalization, and of course the politics being what they are, you can only have an ounce, and we got to really restrict the home grow, and Washington, no home grow at all. Well, that set up a situation where here you have this really robust, strongly regulated, strictly controlled recreational side, and then free-for-all over in the medical side. Not quite free-for-all, but you know, far more plants, far more possession. And that got the legislators concerned, at least in the state of Oregon. They got all freaked out about that idea because, oh no, that's going to lead to diversion. You know, people aren't going to get into the recreational program. They'll just go to the medical program. A little harder to get into the Oregon program than the Washington program, but still easy enough that it concerned them. Another thing that happened in Oregon is some bad timing in the media. We had, just as 91, either before it passed or just after it passed, but it was really close timeline-wise, a story come out in the Oregonian from our marijuana beat reporter. Her name's Noelle Crombie, and she told a story of how the largest medical marijuana garden in the state of Oregon serves 104 patients, and not one of those patients lives in Oregon. Oregon's the only state that doesn't have residency requirement for its medical marijuana. So growers, and this grower in Southern Oregon had stacked up all these out-of-state California cards. With each card, he can grow 6 mature plants. So that's a garden with, it's not a garden, it's a farm with 624 mature marijuana plants in it, right? And that freaked the legislature out. Oh my God, medical's being used for diversion. They keep throwing around this number, 75% of the medical marijuana goes to the black market. Nobody knows where they got that number from, but they keep quoting it for some reason. So politically, what we had happen is Measure 91 said three pretty serious things. Number one, medical marijuana shall not be affected in any way. Do not affect medical marijuana. And this was put in because, you know, patients pretty much demanded it. Don't change our medical program. So Measure 91 didn't mention it a bit. Another thing we added in there was that only a vote of the people can ban marijuana licenses. The city council can't, in a 3-2 decision, ban marijuana. It has to go to the ballot. The people have to vote on it. And number three, that only the state can tax marijuana. Your locality, your county can't add its own marijuana tax. Those last two things were copied from our liquor laws. That's exactly what you have to do to ban liquor in Oregon, is have a vote of the people, and only the state can tax liquor. So as this passed, the legislature put together this joint committee. Ha-ha. Tell you, they made that joke so many times. They put together this joint committee, 5 representatives from the House, 5 senators from the Senate, Both the House and Senate in Oregon are democratically controlled, so it was 3-2, like three House Democrats, two House Republicans, three Senate Democrats, two Senate Republicans. And for anything to get out of this committee, they had to have a 3-2 vote on both sides. You know, a majority of the House guys, majority of the Senate guys. And they were impaneled. They were called the Measure 91 Joint Implementation Committee. Their whole job was to implement recreational marijuana. So they spent their entire 90 days arguing how to restrict medical. They didn't do a single thing about what our recreational program was going to be. They spent the entire time arguing about how they're going to restrict medical. And they came to agreement on a lot of things. They agreed we're going to cut down the total number of plants that you can have in a residence to 12. No more 6 per patient, 12 total. You're going to cut down the rural plants from however many cards you've got to 48 total. And I know red state friends out here, you're going, 48 plants, awesome. But to some of our, you know, growers who are out there caring for 6 cancer patients, that meant 2 of their patients are going to be out of their 6 plants. So this was having an effect on people. They agreed on a whole bunch of stuff that they wanted to get through, and the committee was ready to pass this bill that severely restricted medical marijuana, except they couldn't agree on one provision, and that was, when we passed our dispensaries in 2013, the localities were allowed to do moratoriums on them, or bans on them, up through May 1st of this year. And so 146 out of 242 Oregon cities did that, and 26 out of 36 Oregon counties did that. So bans on medical marijuana outlets all over the state. Well, as of May 1st, they're no longer allowed to do these bans, and we think that all these places that still have bans are violating the law now, because that, you know, there's your deadline, May 1st. The cities and counties lobbyists want to have the power to ban medical marijuana through a city council vote. They want to do a 3-2 vote, no medical marijuana. Despite the fact the recreational we passed said you need a vote of the people to ban recreational. And as one of the House Democrats pointed out, it shouldn't be easier to ban a medical dispensary than a recreational dispensary. That makes no sense. So it deadlocked because, surprisingly, the Senate Democrats wanted to go along with that let the city councils ban language. 3 House Democrats stood up against that and deadlocked the whole committee. They said instead the bans should automatically go to the ballot and the people should decide. So that committee deadlocked. So our Senate president just said, all right, I'm forming a Senate committee with the same 5 senators. They just passed this bill and now they're sending it to the full Senate for a vote that will allow local bans on medical. And of course, if they get local bans on medical, you know they're going to put through local bans on recreational. And once they've set the precedent that we are local control, they're going to throw in the local taxes too. So as we move forward, the lesson I would say from Oregon, especially for California or any other state that's got medical like Nevada or Arizona that'll be voting on it, is I'm just going to say it. It's impossible for medical marijuana to not be affected by legalization. Because you're going to have 2 parallel systems running together. So the question then becomes, how much can you make them alike or can you integrate them? And I would say that a mistake we made was not including medical in our legalization. Since we didn't put any language in about medical, we had nothing to protect any of the medical. Had we written some medical in, had we said, okay, the dispensaries will be XYZ and they'll merge in with the recreational or they'll, whatever we would have put in there at least would have given us something to have defense for medical. As it is, we were told to keep hands off it and now the legislature's got their hands all over it. So be cognizant of the fact that that's going to be in any state that has medical already, it's going to be a nightmare trying to figure out how to reconcile those 2 things. And like you said, some of the people you thought were your allies turn out to be very angry at you for supporting legalization.
Yeah. Kind of like Russ said, and I'll let Kevin talk more about Colorado than I will, but Colorado's model of medical marijuana was highly regulated. It already met the 8 tenets the DOJ ultimately handed down for our legalization schemes to work, our states, rather. And Washington was probably, and I say was because it's been forever changed in this legislative session, Washington's medical marijuana was the most loosely regulated. You have your 15 plants as a patient. If you were a provider for someone, you could have 30. If you had two patients living at the place, you could have 45. And like stacking cards, you had people say, well, I guess I'll just start a storefront then, and we'll call it a, I don't know what they called them, but you know, they're just not outlined in the law. And even California's model allows for some taxation of collective gardens, which Washington's never did. There's absolutely no regulations. And I don't know what the perspective is of Washington State from a lot of you from around the country, but there's a real viable industry out there. It's not like as sophisticated as Colorado's because they had that regulation. Having that regulation allowed Colorado, of course, to flip to recreational right away. And the first year of their legalization, they only allowed those people who had followed the law and become licensed and compliant in medical to get a recreational license. In Washington, like Russ said, we couldn't, given the initiative process, it has to be a single line, like you can only adjust one law at a time. We couldn't approach RCW 6951A, which is revised code of Washington's medical marijuana law, and 6950, which is our controlled substances law. And as far as coalition building goes, their medical marijuana community, they weren't consulted. They weren't. Law enforcement was consulted. Treatment was consulted. The funders and founders of I-502, our allies at the ACLU, our friend Rick Steves, one of the major funders, they wanted the monies from the taxation of legal marijuana to go to very specific campaigns, very specific allocations in the budget. Since this is a budgetary session in Washington State, we've now found that there's a lot of people who want the money who maybe don't want the pot. And so the logic is, if you're a county that doesn't want marijuana, it's, you know, for the safety of the kids, even though a large portion of the tax allocation dollars of I-502 went to youth prevention and treatment, those same counties are now saying, well, we'll take the money from the kids and we'll let you have a pot shop if you give us the money. But really, as far as medical goes in Washington, it never was regulated and it never was addressed. And that's part of the problem that we're having now, is juxtaposed to a highly regulated, legally regulated system of production and distribution and adult personal use, there is this Wild West out in Washington, and it's not taxed and it's not regulated. Now it is. Senate Bill 5052 passed. The governor signed it into law a few weeks ago. Gone are the possession limits. It's 3 ounces. Gone are the plant counts. It's 3 plants. Gone are the dispensaries. Unless you're licensed up, you will be closed down next July. Not this July, but they will come after you next July. In the meantime, they're starting to cite some of those folks with minor infractions and other tickets, which will keep them out of the running for ultimate licensure once they get those violations. When we think of medical marijuana long term, I look at it from a historical perspective. Look at language, right? Pot's been around a lot longer than language. It's been around longer than recreational weed or medical weed. You know, I smoke it because, you know, well, to steal Keith's phrase, I like it a lot. It makes me feel good, and I'm a medical patient because it gives me an affirmative defense. And the doctor said I have something, but I don't. I mean, not enough for me to really need medical marijuana. But if you have those laws, they're good to take advantage of. But in the long run, I see the GW sign over here. You know, it's going to be GW Pharmaceuticals. It's going to be Sativex. That's medical marijuana. The pharmaceuticalization is the Box Canyon, you know, that you guys we've talked about for years. I've heard rumors that Obama might reschedule to a Schedule II drug at the end of on his way out of office after the election. That wouldn't benefit us at all. That would only help GW Pharmaceuticals. It wouldn't even open the door for 280E reform. It just might open up the discussion. But medical marijuana in Washington now is going to be assigned to those retail stores that have Washington State Liquor Control Board licenses, and they will now be required to get a certificate from the Department of Health, which will train their bud tenders on the efficacy of medical marijuana, which will be grown by licensed producers who opt in a certain allotment of their canopy to go exclusively to those medical marijuana sections in the store. It seems weird to me because I'm going to grow the same strain for both sides. It's going to be treated the same. It's just going to be taxed differently at the end user. And when I say end user, I mean recreational or medical. People are still going to get their pot. They're not dying in the streets in Idaho, where there is no marijuana. I mean, there is, but you know, there's no marijuana laws. So a lot of the cries, a lot of the vitriol, all of the vitriol is coming from people who have a horse in the medical marijuana race in Washington, the unregulated race. And it's either their defense attorneys or it's people who are making money, even if it's just enough money to make a house payment or a car payment. There's also some larger dispensary owners who are really against it. But there's also some dispensaries who are now lobbying very hard for the right to try to get a license, even though they had a chance like everybody else. But medical marijuana in Washington is not anymore.
Happy 420, everyone.
Yeah. But
well, and I have to agree with both Russ and Kevin in regard to Colorado's robust regulations of our medical program. It's allowed it to kind of go, there hasn't been much done to it since its passage. After the recreational marijuana passed in 2012, it was literally one of the first things that we did in the rulemaking groups was take the rules for the medical and put them over into recreational and then just doctor it up. It was literally, that's how we were able to come up with the regulatory framework so quickly, is because we just adopted our medical, tweaked it in regard to the age limits and things like that, but it's straight up off the medical program. What we're seeing in Colorado is more of a crackdown on the caregiver program that we have in the state. The medical marijuana program, of course, I think is at risk because there's an attempt to maybe be more rigorous at the qualifications in regard to chronic pain. Roughly 120,000 medical marijuana patients in Colorado, and about 93% of them claim chronic pain as their debilitating condition for medical marijuana. So there is an attempt to address that, and of course, if you remove 93% of the market, that instantly is going to force medical dispensaries to either make that decision to convert over to the recreational market or just go out of business. Is again looking in the next legislative session or two. This past session that just ended, as I mentioned earlier, about state-level lobbying, what we saw was the caregivers. In the city of Denver alone, enforcement agents came across 800 unlicensed grows. And these weren't grows with like five plants with your buddy. There were like 3,000 square foot warehouses in the industrial areas of the city. And so regulators, along with industry, right, because the industry that's regulated there, the recreational industry, they've paid thousands upon thousands of dollars to have the opportunity to participate. And what they're seeing is folks running under the caregiver model or growing 1,000 plants without paying any licensing. They're not going through any of the requirements that the regulated model is. And so you have a two-front attack on what's going on with these caregivers. And basically the compromise that they came up with, and I think it's a pretty decent compromise, is allowing caregivers to genuinely, if you're genuinely taking care of your patients, which again, we do have a lot of epileptic children and marijuana refugees that have moved to Colorado. So, it's important that we do everything that we can to keep the medical program in place, but allow them to responsibly grow for their patients. So we put a cap of 99 plants, which I think is more than fair for a caregiver taking care of. I think they capped the patient limit at 5, no more than 99 plants. And from that was feedback from the medical community saying, I need at least 2 ounces to make a few grams of the oil that my patients need. And from that testimony and that input, the state increased, again, the limits to 99 plants. And they're also forced to register with the state. And so there has been a little bit of a crackdown on the caregiver side. But I think the medical will continue to be an issue. The one advantage I think that we have in Colorado is it's a constitutional amendment, Amendment 20. So we're constitutionally guaranteed to have access to medical marijuana in the state of Colorado. So I don't see the program going away completely in the state, but I see, you know, again, continued attempts to minimize access to the medical program. You know, I've met with council members in the city of Denver, and they're just, their question to me is why aren't more people participating in the regulated side? You know, of course, because they're looking at not only the tax revenues that are generated, but the licensing that the city makes. You know, it's looking at $10,000 per license. You know, so there's a lot of incentive for the city to start moving people into that, into the recreational market. And even regulators look at it and they say, well, you know, I mean, it's we have virtual separation. So you have a huge, you know, 10,000 square foot warehouse, and there's literally a line of blue tape down the middle of the room. And regulators come in and they say, where's your medical? Yep. It's right there. Where's your rec? It's right there. Yeah. And it's the same strains. Yeah. And so it does create a burden for regulators in the state, right? And again, I'm in full disclosure, I'm a medical marijuana patient. I've had my card since 2010 in Colorado. And, you know, I don't want to see them do this. But, of course, I think it's going to be the natural progression for people to start cracking down on these medical shops and caregivers to increase participation into the regulated market. Mm-hmm. And looking at other states, and, you know, luckily I have Paul Armentano to kind of lean on in regard to some of his research. We're looking at some of the future of medical marijuana and, you know, states moving across, you know, on the East Coast. You're seeing stuff like non-combustible marijuana in, you know, attempts to pass medical marijuana. So medical marijuana as we know it now in Oregon, and I guess not so much in Washington, but, you know, in Colorado, it's not going to be the same as we move forward. We're going to see more and more restrictions on, you know, the way it's delivered, the way it's packaged and produced. So
I should qualify, what they removed from Washington are the dispensaries, and there's no more medical marijuana industry that's out there to evolve. It's all got to be regulated. Well, they'll still be a patient provider,
okay.
But they have been severely restricted in their possession limits, their plant counts, and the doctor's recommendations are going to be tightened up extremely.
Right.
And as long as we're all here, I just want to say, on the night of the election, Colorado gets all the credit for legalizing first. but I just want to say, if there was no time zones, we did it 20 minutes first, 20 minutes earlier. If there were no time zones, we did it 20.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And a quick follow-up on something that Kevin mentioned about it being a constitutional amendment. This is something to think about as you move forward. Colorado passed it as a constitutional amendment. Legislature can't touch it. Washington passed theirs. They have a special thing in their constitution that says when the people pass an initiative, the legislature can't mess with it for 2 years unless they get a two-thirds majority.
It's been 2 years.
Oregon, we don't have any of that. And that's why from the minute they hit the ground, you know, once it was passed to them, it's just a suggestion. It's just advice. They can do anything they want to it. So think about whether you want to go the statutory route or the amendment route. The bonus of the amendment route is they can't mess with it. The downside is people are more likely to vote no on a constitutional amendment because it's the Constitution. And some people are just don't mess with the Constitution. And it also usually takes a lot more signatures on a constitutional amendment.
And I'd like to also add to Kevin's point about Colorado having a successful rollout, you know, or we were able to roll out so quickly. It was just because, you know, I mean, we had the framework in place, you know, to do it. We just adopted from the medical program. But, you know, it's just something that we just have to be mindful of as we move forward. You know, the constitutional amendment's great. It protects us and it provides access, you know. But I think with the constitutional amendment, there's much more protections, like Russ just alluded to. The state legislature is not allowed to do it. They just basically have to adopt it. And one of the things that we were lucky enough to have in our constitutional amendment in Colorado was deadlines. So the state couldn't drag their feet. Legislators couldn't drag their feet in regard to the implementation. There was very specific dates that said you have to have the framework in place by this day. You have to have it implemented by this day. You have to have drafts prepared this day. And so thankfully, we didn't get lost in the process or they didn't, you know, drag their feet on it. So.
I have questions, and then I'm afraid I'll really have time.
Yeah, I wanted to ask actually about this implementation, especially on the cultivation side of Kevin. In California, we're in 2016, we're looking at doing a unitary approach. We're going to regulate cannabis, and that includes medical cannabis and adult use cannabis, and it will be different kinds of licenses, including a medical-only license, or an adult use license, because we know that from polling, some communities are only comfortable with medical and not others are comfortable with full fit.
Right.
That might say, so we had a task before, we had this enormous industry, the largest one in the world actually, that's pseudo-medical at the moment, plus there's a lot exported out of state too. We would like to bring as much of that industry online now. All of these people, there are, the estimates are there's over 40,000 growers in Northern California alone. So we would like to get as many of them licensed as possible. The problem is, when you actually do the math on this, and you look at the amount of growing area you need to satisfy the state of California, it's only like 900 acres. All right?
Yep.
Now, there are single farms that are that large, and there are capitalists out there who would be willing to put in a bid for a 900-acre farm and do the monopoly in the state. We, of course, would rather have lots of little farms. But, you know, it's not fair that we can accommodate 40,000 growers. I wanted to ask you, Kevin, how do they allocate, how do they allocate the number of plants or the amount of marijuana that different people can have? Do they cap that?
So this actually kind of falls under our little lobbying post-legalization. We wanted as many small growers, because, right, we would all love to be small growers. I can't believe none of us aren't. So the law itself said that the limit on license fees was going to be a $250 application and a $1,000 annual fee for licensing. So that immediately allowed anybody with $250 to apply for a license. The question then during rulemaking became, what will that allow the licensee to do? Do they need $250,000 bond? Are we going to only allow 3 or 4, licenses? But the fees were already set in 502. So that's one thing you'll need to consider is don't price out the little guy. During the rulemaking process, we went all over the state. We followed the LCB. They're very accommodating. They wanted our advice. I've made close friendships with some of the board now. We lobbied hard. I got some great press for Normal, wearing his gold pin. The whole world's watching. When it first came out, when the law first changed, we lobbied publicly and privately to allow as many growers as possible, and we lined them up and used our outreach to bring everybody in to these meetings to lobby. We're talking 400 or 500 people packing out city halls from Spokane to Seattle. And ultimately, they heard it. Now, they received about 3,000 applications for growing, and there were 3 different tiers, up to 5,000 feet, up to 10,000 feet, up to 30,000 feet. And you could get 3 licenses of each one. As it is now, about 300 or 400 growers are actually licensed. And if you don't have a location now, a year into it, that's it. It looks like there's only going to be about 300 or 400 growers for the state of Washington. So I don't know. I mean, you want everybody to get able to get into the game, but if they don't do it right away, I mean, there's going to be tier ones that survive. There's going to be tier threes that don't. The small and the big. It's a weird balance, and it's an economic game that unless you have some business acumen as well, just going from being a grower your whole life and jumping into a highly regulated and highly taxed system doesn't ensure your success as a viable business.
Rob, I know you have one brief question.
Yeah, real quick. We said earlier today that marijuana is going to be legalized, and there was some earlier discussion about when did the Berlin Wall actually fall, and when did marijuana legalization really happen. But it's going to happen, and it's interesting you brought up about constitutional power, and where is that going to be limited when marijuana is legalized, and Kentucky can pour out more pot than it can possibly consume, and ships it across the different state boundary levels, right? And there's no federal regulation. And these constitutional things, that will they really block Kentucky going into
interstate commerce? Comes into play.
Yeah.
Interstate commerce?
So just, and I'll just,
can you repeat the question, please?
I'll try to be real quick. So in Washington State, they've got a great beer industry, great wine industry, and a great distilled spirits industry. You can go to Washington, D.C. here and buy Washington State wines. And there's about 200 or 300 wine producers, you know, more or less little guys. They're competing with the Gallo sellers, and same with their microbrew beers, competing with the Budweiser guys. My hope is that they're going to protect their marijuana industry the same way, since it's actually the same regulatory agency, and that there will be an opportunity to, once interstate commerce comes down, for me to sell my product, Washington's Finest Cannabis, here in this Washington. Even though it might be a pretty long commute to drop off a couple of pounds, because I don't anticipate I'll ever be big marijuana. Yeah, but I anticipate in the long run, there'll be a Philip Morris of pod, and there'll be, you know, a very small boutique businesses.
And constitutional concerns aren't driving, I can't speak to their states, but I know what's driving the fear in Oregon amongst our legislature is the Cole memo. They all think that the 8 priorities of the Cole memo, specifically to not allow the extra state distribution of marijuana, not to allow leakage out of the state, is why our legislators are coming down so hard on our medical program, because again, they believe this fiction that 75% of the medical weed is going to the black market. So that's what's got them scared, is this Cole memo. And I think we're kind of in the same boat as like Washington State in 2011. They tried to regulate their dispensaries, yeah. And because the feds made these unrealized vague threats, their governor then, Christine Gregoire, line item vetoed all the stuff that, had she not, you guys wouldn't be in the situation you're in. You'd have
where
a lot
is she
of
now?
Stuff, you know? Yeah, it's just, so a lot of this is being driven by fear at the federal level, and really, I think the feds are bluffing. They don't have the resources to go after an entire Pacific Northwest or a Kentucky or any of those guys.